Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, November 28th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some news from Fort Dodge. Our first headline today reads, 3-2-1, Santa lights up downtown Fort Dodge. A special visitor from the North Pole brought the cheery glow of Christmas lights to two high-profile spots in downtown Fort Dodge Monday evening. After a crowd of some 40 people, mostly children, counted down 3-2-1, Santa Claus worked his magic, and white lights all around the gazebo of the city square flickered to life. A few minutes later, the process was repeated on a Christmas tree that towers over the intersection of Central Avenue and 12th Street. And while the lighting work was done, Santa was not finished for the evening. He and Mrs. Claus moved indoors to the Wells Fargo building, located at 822 Central Avenue, to meet their fans of all ages. Among those who gathered at the city square Monday evening was Corbin Bardson of Fort Dodge. He is 5, but will be 6 in a couple of days. He said he saw Santa once before when he was little. Was he excited to see Santa? Yes, he said. Bardson said he will be writing Santa a letter in which he will ask for some plushies, a kind of stuffed animal for Christmas. With the temperature hovering around 20 degrees, families stayed in their vehicles until Santa arrived at the city square. The jolly old elf had given Rudolph and the rest of the reindeer the night off and traveled in a trailer pulled by a pickup. When the trailer stopped alongside the city square, children burst from the parked vehicles and dashed to meet the man of honor. Excuse me, the man of the hour, rather, attired in his classic red suit. Handshakes, high fives, and hugs followed as the Clauses made their way to the gazebo. I'm so excited to welcome Santa and Mrs. Claus here tonight, Mayor Matt Bemrich said. He said the special event was made possible by Main Street Fort Dodge, which does a great job of reminding us what a good thing we have in downtown Fort Dodge and why Santa likes to visit us down here so much, he said. He then led the countdown, which ended with Santa turning on the lights. Santa then worked his magic on a tree which stands more than 50 feet high at Veterans Triangle Park at Central Avenue and 12th Street. Crews from MidAmerican Energy placed the lights on that tree. At the Wells Fargo building, kids could meet the Clauses, write letters to Santa, and make a craft item. Hot cider and hot chocolate were provided by Artist Made Coffee and Dessert of Fort Dodge. Our next local news headline reads, Hardy Teen Killed in Webster County Crash. A teenage boy was killed last Wednesday when the driver of a pickup truck ran a rural stop sign in Webster County, plowing into the sedan the boy was a passenger in. According to a crash report from the Iowa State Patrol, Logan Christensen, aged 37, of Eagle Grove, was driving a 2014 Ram pickup truck westbound on 110th Street at about 3:42 p.m. on Wednesday when he blew a stop sign and hit a 2014 Toyota sedan driven by Sarah Sanga, age 33, of Hardy, that was traveling northbound on Union Avenue. Both vehicles landed in the northwest ditch of the intersection. Sanga's 13-year-old son, Kyle Hilbert of Hardy, was pronounced dead at the scene and transported to Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center by Fort Dodge Ambulance. Sanga sustained serious injuries and was taken to Des Moines Methodist Medical Center by Life Flight. Christensen was also injured in the crash and was transported by ambulance to TRMC. According to the crash report, all three were wearing seatbelts at the time of the crash. The Iowa State Patrol was assisted by the Webster County Sheriff's Office, Webster County Medical Examiner, Fort Dodge Fire Rescue, Thor Fire Department, and Badger Fire Department. Our next headline reads, Ball Diamond Project Approved. Triton Softball Squad will play in Yankee Stadium. Fort Dodge Ball Diamond will get artificial turf and become the designated home field of the Iowa Central Community College softball team. The City Council on Monday approved two items, an agreement with the college and a contract for some of the necessary work to make that possible. Lori Branderhurst, the city's Director of Parks, Recreation, and Forestry, said the project is a benefit for the city, the region, and Iowa Central softball. The Triton softball team has played on other diamonds at the city's Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sport Complex for about 10 years. She added that it will provide an additional field that would help to accommodate the potential transition of the annual Girl State Softball Tournament to a double elimination format. The sports complex has been the site of that tournament for more than 50 years. A replica of Yankee Stadium will be getting the upgrades. The local version of the historic home of the New York Yankees is at the northeast end of the complex, along with reproductions of Fenway Park in Boston, Wrigley Field in Chicago, and Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. Collectively, these fields are known as the mini majors. Branderhurst said Yankee Stadium was chosen because it has more of the infrastructure needed to make it a high school and junior college level softball field. She said it has netting to stop foul balls, which wraps around the home plate backstop and both dugouts. It also has bleachers, and there is enough room there to extend the outfield to 200 feet in the center field. The council on Monday approved an agreement with Iowa Central in which the college will pay 50% of the cost of installing artificial turf for a maximum of $400,000. That money will be paid to the city in the 2024 and 2025 fiscal years. In return, Iowa Central will get reduced field rental rates through 2033. What's good for us is good for Iowa Central, Mayor Matt Bemrich said. Also on Monday, the council hired Doyle Construction of Fort Dodge to do some work on Yankee Stadium. The company will remove the existing fences and dugouts, do some earthwork, build new dugouts, and relocate the scoreboard. That work is to be done by May 1, 2024. The company will be paid $115,294. The entire project, including installation of the turf, is to be done by July 1, 2024. Councilwoman Lydia Schur and Megan Secor were absent from the otherwise unanimous votes to approve the agreement with Iowa Central and the contract. Our next local headline reads, Sac County man still missing after 1 week, and the dateline is Lakeview. A week after a Lakeview man was reported missing under strange circumstances, law enforcement are continuing to try to locate him and bring answers to his family. According to a press release from the Sac County Sheriff's Office, 53-year-old David Schultz was reported missing on November 21st. Schultz was last seen by his family on the evening of November 20th when he left for work, according to an update shared by a family member on GoFundMe. He was scheduled to pick up a semi-trailer of hogs in Eagle Grove and haul them to Sac City the next day. However, Sarah Schultz was notified on the morning of November 21st that her husband never arrived in Sac City with the load, though it was picked up in Eagle Grove. On the afternoon of November 21st, the semi-trailer David Schultz was driving was found unlocked, parked in the middle of the road on U.S. Highway 71, northeast of Sac City, according to Sarah Schultz. The missing man's cell phone, wallet, and cash were located inside the truck, and his coat was located in a nearby ditch. The trailer was still full of hogs. Search efforts began soon after the man's disappearance, eventually spanning the route David Schultz is believed to have driven before he disappeared. Over the weekend, volunteers searched areas in Calhoun, Sac, Webster, and Wright counties. Jake Rowley, Midwest team leader for the organization United Cajun Navy, is also organizing search efforts through his Facebook page. On Monday, the Sac County Sheriff's Office put out a release noting that the search continues and there was nothing new to report. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation has joined the Sac County Sheriff's Office and Lakeview Police Department in the investigation. David Schultz is described as a 53-year-old white male, approximately 5 foot 11 inches and 180 pounds. He has brown hair and brown eyes. He was last known to be wearing Wrangler blue jeans, cowboy boots, and a Peterbilt hat. Anyone with information related to Schultz's disappearance is encouraged to call the Sac County Communications Center at 712-662-7127. With the financial strain and uncertainty looming over David Schultz's family, a GoFundMe has been set up to help support his wife and children during this time. To donate, visit GoFundMe/BF0031A0. Our next headline reads, School Board Welcomes New Members. The three newly elected members of the Fort Dodge Community School District Board of Education were sworn in and took their seats on the board during Monday's meeting. Emily Denklau, Brian Peterson, and Keenan Schuer were each elected to their first terms on the board this fall. Board member Diane Pratt was reelected to her second term on the board. When bidding farewell to outgoing board members Bill Kent, Angie Tracy, and Matt Moritz, Board President Stu Cochran said he didn't want to overlook the other candidates that ran for school board this fall. "It's challenging, as you know, to put yourself out there and to put your name on the dotted line and ask for people in the public to vote for you to do something as significant as being a volunteer and part of the education process," he said. "So even those that aren't successful, I think it's noteworthy, and we appreciate the fact that people are willing to step up for this most commendable cause," he said. During Monday's meeting, Cochran was unanimously reelected to the role of board president. Board member Dan Altman was then unanimously elected to the role of vice president. "Thank you, board. I appreciate it," Cochran said after the vote. "I know I've said this before, but I don't take this for granted. The fact that I have an opportunity to work with all of you and lead you on the board means a lot," he said. With three new members, Cochran said he's looking forward to working with this, quote, young board. "We're going to learn a lot of things," he said. "We're going to do a lot of good." In other business, the board approved the preliminary plans and estimated cost for a project to renovate the nearly century-old Dodger Stadium. The project includes tearing down the existing home locker room, rebuilding the locker room, adding on to the concessions area, adding a new entrance, adding new restrooms, and upgraded handicap parking, said Ryan Utley, Director of Buildings and Grounds for the district. In all, the project is estimated to cost about $6 million, which includes roughly $5.4 million for the construction. Utley explained that this is a project that he has been working on with several previous boards and several previous athletic directors. "This addresses safety, addresses parking, and it addresses handicap accessibility. Those things have been issues as much as the locker room has," Superintendent Josh Porter said. "I don't know if we've done a remodel or anything at Dodger Stadium for, I'm going to say, over 50 years, maybe since 1936 when it was built." What the board approved on Monday were the tentative plans for the project and cost estimate, and directing Utley to put the project out to bid. Bids will be due by 2 p.m. on December 19th, and a public hearing will be scheduled for January 8th during the board's regular meeting. The Dodger Stadium project will be paid for using funds from the district's revenue, from state sales tax, and physical plant and equipment levy, said Brandon Hansel, executive director of financial services for the district. We've been saving up for the last few years, and we're going to be paying cash for the project, he said. And now turning to today's obituaries for Fort Dodge, we first remember Ashley McGuffey. Ashley Clara McGuffey, age 39, of Grove, Oklahoma, died May 17th in Fort Dodge. No services are planned, and Bruce's funeral home is handling arrangements. Next, we remember Pamela Hack. Pamela A. Hack, age 55, of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, November 25th, at Fort Dodge Health and Rehabilitation. A graveside service at Corpus Christi Cemetery will be at 1 p.m. Thursday, November 30th. Loffersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. Next, we remember Ruth Walsh. Ruth Ethel Walsh passed away on November 26th at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. She left us while sleeping peacefully at the age of 87 with her family by her side. Her loved ones invite friends to share their memories of Ruth during a visitation at the Larson Weishauer Funeral Home on Wednesday, November 29th, beginning with a rosary service at 3:30 p.m., with visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. The Mass of Christian Burial will be held at St. Thomas Catholic Church, located at 1076 8th Street in Manson, on Thursday, November 30th at 10:30 a.m., with Father Lynn Bruch officiating. Interment will follow at St. Patrick's Cemetery in Lizard Township in Clare. Next, we remember Charles Clausen. Charles Clausen, age 73, of Fort Dodge, died Monday, November 27th at his home. Arrangements have been entrusted to Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Next, we remember Jim Perkopile, Jr. Services for Jim will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, December 9th at Historic Bruce Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Friday, December 8th. Next, we remember Jeff Tinker. Funeral services for Jeff will be today, Tuesday, November 28th at 6 p.m. at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove, with visitation from 4 to 6 p.m. And now turning to today's news briefs. This headline reads, deceased female found during house fire in Rockwell City last week. And the dateline is Rockwell City. While extinguishing a structure fire in the 100 block of North Elm Street last Wednesday, Rockwell City firefighters discovered a deceased female in the residence, according to a release from the Rockwell City Fire Chief Shane Voth. According to the release posted by Voth on the department's Facebook page, the Rockwell City Fire Department was dispatched to the fire at about 2:35 p.m. on November 22nd. When they found heavy fire conditions, but knocked the fire down quickly. That was when firefighters found the deceased female in the residence. The release did not indicate whether the deceased female is believed to have died prior to the fire or as a result of the fire. The identity of the deceased female has not been released. The cause of the fire remains under investigation. The Rockwell City Fire Department was assisted by Calhoun County Emergency Medical Services, Calhoun County Sheriff's Office, Rockwell City Police Department, and the Iowa State Fire Marshal's Office. Our next news brief headline reads, Fort Dodge Police Department gets two new officers. Two new Fort Dodge police officers will be reporting for duty today. Officers Madison Anderson and Kevin Smith were introduced to the City Council Monday evening. They are filling two vacancies, which will bring the police department up to its full strength of 40 members. Anderson is a graduate of Eagle Grove High School. She earned an associate degree from Iowa Central Community College and a bachelor's degree from Buena Vista University in Storm Lake. She is a veteran of the Iowa National Guard. Smith is a graduate of Southeast Valley High School. He most recently worked at FedEx. And now turning to local sports. This headline reads, home debut for Dodger bowlers. The Fort Dodge bowling teams made their home debut here Monday at Family Bowling Center versus Des Moines Lincoln. In the boys' match, the Rails posted a 2,730 to 2,430 victory, while Lincoln also captured the girls' duel with 2,760 to 2,041. Trenton Beck had games of 191 and 196 to lead the Dodger boys with a 387 series. Evan Haig added a 325, followed by Noah Winiger at 315, Josh Jass at 298, and Brian Keenan at 290. Slade Babb had a 286 and Leland Sassman a 257 on junior varsity, as Lincoln won 1,848 to 1,585. For the Fort Dodge Senior High girls, Bailey Wilson's 124 to 183 was the top series at 307, with Amira Lumpson right behind at 306. Samantha Welter added a 280, Sol Berkey a 279, Callie Graves a 256, and Samantha Anderson at 249. Lincoln won the junior varsity duel, 1,942 to 1,477, as Paige Lewis had a 223 and Natalie Anderson at 205. We saw growth from almost everybody in terms of scoring. Coach Vinson said, "We had stronger games of Bakers compared to last week. It's just going to take time to figure it all out." Fort Dodge returns to action next Monday when they host Des Moines Hoover and Urbandale. Our next local sports headline reads, Fort Dodge girls win opener at Boone, 41-34, and the dateline is Boone. The Fort Dodge girls kicked off the 2023-2024 season with a 41-34 victory here Monday night over Boone. The Dodgers, who are 1-0 overall, also started last year off with a win over the Toreadors on their way to a 12-10 mark, tying for the most wins in a season for the program since the season of 2006-2007. Sophomore LJ Mall led the way with 16 points, adding 9 rebounds and 4 blocked shots. Junior Mia McCaleb had 6 points, 10 rebounds, 4 steals, and 3 assists, while sophomore Dakota Palmer had 7 points with 4 rebounds and 3 steals. The Toreadors, who are 3-1 overall, posted victories over Webster City, Des Moines East, and Nevada last week. Junior Ashlyn Wills, junior Brooklyn Palmer, and senior Mackenzie McElrath each scored 4 points, as Palmer had 5 rebounds and 4 steals. The Dodgers play their next 2 games at home, hosting Ames on Friday and Des Moines Hoover next Tuesday. And we have this local sports headline, Fort Dodge Senior High Boys drop opener. The dateline is Boone. The Fort Dodge boys basketball squad couldn't keep pace with Boone in their season opener on Monday night. The Dodgers, who have a busy 3-game week right out of the chute, lost 62-39 to the Toreadors. Fort Dodge trailed by as many as 26 points in the second and third quarters. Junior Cade Westerhoff led the Dodgers with 16 points, with classmate Drake Warlin adding 14. Junior Carter Westerhoff contributed 4 points, with sophomore Tytrell Mosley 3 and senior Ty Adams 2, rounding out the scoring. Fort Dodge hosts Clear Lake on Tuesday and Ames on Friday. The Lions were a Class 3A state finalist a year ago and returned 4 starters this season. The Little Cyclones reached the 4A quarterfinals in 2022-2023. And you are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, November 28th on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's news for for Mason City. And our first Mason City headline today reads, Mason City Council approves land sale for Hyatt Place development. The Mason City Council has approved a downtown land sale that should clear the way for construction to begin on a 131-room hotel project. The council Wednesday voted to approve the sale to MCCCH LLC, formerly known as Gatehouse Mason City LLC, for the proposed Hyatt Place Hotel. The resolution, originally dated October 20, 2015, is a light at the end of a years-long development tunnel. MCCCH LLC has secured a loan from Stearns Bank, backed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It also has chosen a Minnesota contractor for construction of the hotel. Closing is expected to be completed by December 20th. We'll have a groundbreaking announcement right after the closing date, said City Administrator Aaron Burnett. The project began as part of the River City Renaissance Project to make improvements to downtown. Many of those projects have been completed, but delays for the hotel development had been frustratingly regular for city officials. Workers from Hinkle Construction are making last-minute finishing touches to the nearly completed skywalk in anticipation of new construction. Burnett said he's pleased to see the steps forward. This project has been in the works since before I came on, and it's good to see this amendment as indication we're getting close, he said. The development agreement included an amendment updating the final number of rooms in the hotel from 115 to 131. The 800-person ballroom and convention area will be located near the vacant Yonkers store at South Bridge Mall. I think the way this development has played out is going to be a huge benefit for the city. Yes, it was long, but we were able to make adjustments along the way. There are the plans for Southbridge that can be streamlined along with the hotel, Burnett said. It seems like these developments go on forever behind the scenes, and the pandemic extended this one by a lot. But now that we're here, we should start seeing work underway soon. Once contractors begin construction, it is expected to take approximately 18 months to complete the hotel, which should open for business in fall 2025, according to Burnett. Our next local headline reads, Mason City Virtual Academy scores low, according to State. State data from the Iowa Department of Education shows that students at Mason City schools improved in several categories compared to last year, but in many areas continues to fall well below state averages. The Iowa School Performance Profile gives each school a rating based on several factors, including standardized test scores, attendance, staff retention, graduation rates, and suspension rates. At a glance, the recently released 2023 data shows that Mason City schools fall behind the state average in categories measuring graduation rates, as well as growth in English language arts and mathematics. The district has a total enrollment of 3,320 K-12 students, spread out at 8 physical campuses and a virtual academy. Each school receives a score of up to 100 and is placed in one of 6 categories: exceptional, high-performing, commendable, acceptable, needs improvement, and priority. Jefferson and Hoover Elementary schools were designated as high-performing and commendable, respectively. John Adams Elementary, Lincoln Intermediate, and Mason City High School earned acceptable ratings. Alternative school, Harding Elementary, Roosevelt Elementary, need improvement. Mason City Virtual Academy dropped in performance compared to last year in all categories, this year scoring a 39.7 out of 100, targeting the Virtual Academy as a priority. The state's average score is 54.81. Associate Superintendent for Curriculum and Instruction, Bridget Exman, said that the district saw incredible gains in student-student relationships, adult-student relationships, and clear boundaries and expectations. In some places, we saw double-digit gains with results that are higher than state averages. That's certainly not to say there isn't still plenty of room to improve, but rather evidence that when we target an area for improvement, we can and do make positive change, she said. Proficiency scores in mathematics and English language arts are all areas well below state average at the Mason City Virtual Academy, which, as the lowest performing school in the district, was targeted as a priority by the state. Mason City Virtual Academy was established in August 2021 during the COVID-19 emergency through ESSER funds and allows students to continue learning virtually instead of going to a physical classroom. Students use Chromebooks and Google-based technology for their assignments. Teachers use Google Classroom as the web-based platform, which enables them to create an online classroom area in which they can manage all the documents that their students need. Documents are stored on Google Drive and edited in its apps, such as Google Docs and Sheets. As the pandemic-related funding slowly expired, the board in April 2023 approved to restructure Mason City Virtual Academy to now fit under the Alternative Education Program, and to eliminate virtual learning for K-6, making in-person learning the only option for elementary students. Engagement of some students has been difficult. Virtual Academy has not been a good fit for a few students at this age level, Superintendent Pat Hamilton said. He cited data that shows, with only 11 students enrolled, one teacher retirement, and the program's cost exceeding revenue, returning to in-person learning was best for all students K-6. Moving the Virtual Academy to alternative learning, Hamilton added, made sense because many of the students enrolled virtually are utilizing individualized instruction plans and credit recovery, things that the alternative coordinators are already equipped to handle. According to research compiled by the Hechinger Report, which covers inequality and innovation in education, studies show that lost in-person classroom time reduces social and emotional skills, hinders academic progress, and can decrease a student's likelihood of graduating. And consequently, lower levels of education can lead to lower employment and financial prospects in adulthood. Chronic absenteeism in the district was 9.8 points above state average, with 35.4% of students missing 10% or more of school days for any reason, excused or unexcused. Absenteeism among students was found to be disproportionately higher among students who identify as Black, African American, Hispanic, Native American, and Hawaiian or Pacific Islander. Exman said, "This issue is right at the top of our priority list, since kids can't learn what we're teaching if they aren't here. We have contracted with Attendance Works this year to lead district and community conversations, starting in November, to understand the root causes of the attendance issues we see here in Mason City, and to develop a plan that is proactive and community-wide, to get more kids in school every day," she said. Finally, Post-Secondary Readiness Index, measuring students' readiness in preparing for life beyond high school, was lowest scoring category for the district, showing a 37.67 success rate in all categories. Participation in college entrance exam and ACT or SAT scores, college-level post-secondary or advanced coursework, and career and technical education concentrators. "This is an interesting data point that seems to confirm what we have anecdotally tracked," said Exman. "Fewer students intend to attend four-year college or university upon graduation. This data point only looks at ACT and SAT, which typically doesn't include students who intend to enroll in a community college or go directly to work or some other path, such as an apprenticeship program or the military. I read this as support for the work-based learning and school-to-work connections we have been working to build for our community. It also supports the idea that we need to expand our career and technical education programming with more efforts like our recent addition of a welding program, she said. Our next local headline reads, Mason City Schools swears in new school board, makes calendar adjustments for 2024. The Mason City Community School Board of Education, at its November 20th reorganization meeting, retired the former board, reconvening with four new members after their election on November 7th. Retiring from the board were directors Peterson Jean-Pierre, Lori Lala, and Brent Seaton. Catherine Kohler, Jennifer Dorsey Lee, Meg Marcos, and Madison Nelson were all sworn in by acting board president Sherry Yoder, who then held an election for president, which went by unanimous vote to Cindy Garza. The board then unanimously elected Carol Detmer as vice president. The board approved the following adjustments to the 2023-2024 academic year. On Friday, January 26, 2024, there will be a no school day for all students and staff, grades PK through 12. On Thursday, April the 11th, 2024, will be a regular school day for all students and staff, grades PK through 12. On Friday, April 12th, 2024, it will be a no school day for all students, PK through 12, and professional development for Mason City School staff. The board also approved the calendar for its regular meetings. The board meets as a committee of the whole study session on the first Monday of the month, and no action is taken at these meetings. The regular meetings are held the third Monday of the month. Exceptions this year are made for the January 2024 committee of the whole meeting, which will be held Wednesday, January 3rd, and the September 2024 committee of the whole meeting, which will be held Tuesday, September 2nd. And now turning to local obituaries for Mason City. First, we remember James I. Jennings. James I. Jennings, age 94, of Mason City, died Friday, November 24th. Memorial services for James will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, December 4th at Grace Evangelical Free Church, located at 440 North Illinois Avenue in Mason City. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, December 3rd, at Major Erickson Funeral Home. Next, we remember Thomas Allen Kephart. Thomas Allen Kephart, age 89, passed away November 24th. Tom was born in Mason City on July 21st, 1934. A visitation for friends and family will take place at the Estes Ledley Holt Chapel, located at 2121 Cedar Street in Holt, Michigan, on Tuesday, November 28th, today, from 2 to 4 p.m. A short service will follow. Cremation has taken place, and the interment of ashes will take place at a later date at Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Next, we remember Warren D. Seelock. Warren D. Seelock, age 78, of Clear Lake, passed away peacefully November 24th at Mercy One North Medical Center in Mason City, surrounded by his family. Services will be 2 p.m. Thursday, November 30th, at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, located at 310 First Avenue North in Clear Lake, and led by Mark Doble. Family will greet friends and relatives from 12:30 p.m. until service time on Thursday. Next, we remember Charles Rayburn. Charles Harvey Rayburn, age 80, of Mason City, died Wednesday, November 22nd at home. Memorial services will be today at 11 a.m., Tuesday, November 28th, at Hogan Bremer Memorial Colonial Chapel, with Pastor Don Garriott's officiating. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service beginning at 10 a.m. at the funeral home. And now turning to Dear Abby. Abby has one letter today. The headline reads, Readers Detail Options for Tech-Averse Writer. Dear Abby, they write, this is in response to Love My Cheap Phone, which was published on August 28th. As a millennial who has worked in retail my whole adult life, I'm tired of the excuse that the older generation can't or won't use smartphones. Personal computers have been out for decades, and smartphones have been around more than 16 years. Like the automatic transmission, these things are designed to make our lives easier and should be embraced rather than shunned. I have had people cuss me out over not being able to access discounts due to not having a smartphone, going so far as to claim discrimination. The only person holding them back is themselves, and most of the time, smartphones are more intuitive than previously thought. They also all don't cost $1,000. Many basic-use smartphones can be bought for under $200, not to mention certain phone companies offer big discounts on people's first smartphone with a new account. I don't feel bad for Love My Cheap Phone. I suggest they get with the times because these devices aren't going away. And it's signed Millennial in Oregon. And Abby responds, Dear Millennial, thank you for writing. After that letter appeared, I was inundated with comments from readers. Some of them agreed with you. Other readers understood Love's point and offered suggestions for transitioning more easily to a modern communication device. And Abby says, read on. And she includes some other letters that she has received on the subject. One writes, Dear Abby, I'm a senior with mobility issues, and I couldn't live without my smartphone. It is not a toy. I use it to fill my prescriptions, schedule medical appointments, check test results, and communicate with my doctors. I do most of my shopping, conduct all of my banking online, call up ride sharing, make travel arrangements, and keep in touch with friends and family. I encourage Love to open their mind a bit. And that was signed Online Senior in California. And another one writes, Dear Abby, there is a government program, Lifeline, go to fcc.gov, that provides a free smartphone and phone service to low-income people. If someone chooses not to have a smartphone, for other reasons, that's their choice. But no one should go without one because they can't afford it. And that was signed by Mary in Massachusetts. Another one writes, Dear Abby, some states offer the Affordable Connectivity Program, or ACP, which provides free phone service with smartphones and tablets to low-income individuals or those receiving Social Security. A tablet might be the better option to use for the kind of interactions the writer described, and that signed Hopefully Helping Out West. And another writes, Dear Abby, I'm guessing Love has family and friends who have older phones in the junk drawers of their homes. We do. Perhaps someone would be willing to part with one. Also, AARP offers classes to learn how to use smartphones, which I suspect is behind your writer's reluctance to modernize. And that's signed by Kristen in New Hampshire. And finally, another writes, Dear Abby, as a retired librarian who has helped many seniors with their technology, the idea of a $1,000 smartphone is akin to thinking that all cars are Rolls Royces. Many phones can be had for under $200, and some for less than $100. A number of service providers caters to seniors trying to transition from their beloved flip phones. I encourage Love to visit their local library and see what advice they can get there. And it's signed Mr. G in Syracuse, New York. And now turning to Mason City area sports. This headline reads, Clear Lake and Newman Catholic looking for success this season. Clear Lake and Newman Catholic girls basketball each opened their seasons last week. The Lions lost to Ballard, while the Knights defeated Lake Mills. Here is a look at each team heading into the season. Clear Lake has some expectations coming into this season. The Lions made a Class 3A regional final last season and return a lot of the same core. They start the season ranked number 7th by the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union. Zeta Johnson led the team in scoring last season with 13 points per game. She also had 7 rebounds a contest, too. She leads a strong front line that includes Maddie Ott, who scored a team-high 15 in the first game against Ballard. The Lions are a little thin at the guard spots, though. Clear Lake needed to replace Jordan Marilyn and Brooklyn Eden already, and forward Ayla Johnson is still recovering from injuries she suffered over the summer. Adi Dugan, Lydia Bertard, and Alexis Thies started the game. Otherwise, the rest of the Lions roster is full of underclassmen. Bart Smith's squad has 7 freshmen and sophomores. Look for Clear Lake to play competitive in a loaded Class 3A this season, and possibly push for a berth in the state tournament again. The last appearance was in 2021. Newman Catholic finished last season 9-14 with just 1 senior on the roster. This season, the Knights are looking to build on that. All 5 starters return, including leading scorers Sammy Kruckenberg and Liz Kruckenberg. Sammy, a freshman a year ago, averaged 14 points per game. Liz finished with 10 points per contest, with a team best of 6 rebounds a game. Kenna Heeman, Celine Matthews, and Jace Weiner round out this year's projected starters. Newman has a chance to compete in the top of Iowa East this season. It already picked up a win against Lake Mills to start the season 1-0, with the Kruckenbergs combining for 34 points. The team shot 6 of 15 from 3-point range, too. With a more veteran group than a year ago, the Knights could turn a few heads on the court this season. And continuing with sports headlines, is this one, what and whom to watch in the area for the 2023-2024 season? The girls have already kicked off the 2023-2024 wrestling season off to a great start, and today the high school boys will join the party. Pardon if I'm slow to the game, but here are some bold predictions for the 2023-2024 boys wrestling season. First and foremost, it will take yours truly a couple of months to get up to speed with the new weight classes for boys at 106, 113, 120, 136, 132, 138, 144, 150, 157, 165, 175, 190, 215, and 285. I've been at this for 30 plus years, and every time a new weight classes are changed or introduced, my mind needs a few matches to catch up to the new terminology. It should be an entertaining season. Class 3A, Southeast Polk, the 2022 champions, return a salty bunch, as the Rams will look to dethrone Waverly Shell Rock. The Gohawks have won 4 of the last 5 3A titles. Waverly Shell Rock will be in the mix for a trophy, but the Gohawks graduated a ton of firepower in Ryder Block, McCray Haggerty, and Jake Walker. In addition to state champion Boss Diaz returning, the Gohawks have state medalists Riker Graff and Ethan Bibler, as well as lineup veterans Alex Horniak, Zane Behrens, Caden Weatherall, Braxton Westendorf, Xander Wiedemeyer, and Robert Pointer. In Class 2A, defending champion Osage gets the nod here. The Green Devils return 112.5 points from their state title team, and that point total would have finished 2nd last year. Osage could have as many as 4 number 1 wrestlers to open the season. Blake Fox, defending 120 champion. Air Force commit Anders Kittleson, state champion Tucker Stangle, and two-time medal winner Max Gast. A dark horse in the trophy hunt could be Union of LaPorte City. The Knights return state champions Braden Bonsack and Jace Hedeman, who committed to UNI last month. Caleb Olson will be a title contender at 150. If Union can find a couple of other state point producers in its lineup, Hello Hardware and Class 1A, the clear favorite should be five-time defending state champion Don Bosco of Gilbertville. The Dons return state finalists Kyler and Caden Knack, state medalists Cole Frost, Jackson Larson, Andrew Kimball, and Landon Fernandez. Additionally, the Dons add two impact freshmen in Hayden Schwab and Dawson Youngblood. A sixth consecutive title would make state history, as the Dons would be the first to do it. Don Bosco has twice won five in a row, 2005-10 and 2019-23. And Waterloo West won five in a row at 42-46. It would also be the Dons' 16th overall traditional title, which would match it with Lisbon for a second most all-time. Waterloo West has 17 state titles to lead. Dark horse West Hancock. The Eagles could have enough firepower to get in the trophy hunt with a pair of finalists in Teague and Kellen Smith, as well as three other potential podium finishers in Creighton Kelly, Cale Zuhl, and David Smith. Clear Lake sophomore Aiden Hippen is the lone returning state qualifier from either Clear Lake, Mason City, or Newman Catholic. Hippen went 1-2 at 138 pounds at last February's state championship. Mason City will open its season Thursday at home against Des Moines East and Des Moines North. Clear Lake will wrestle Tuesday at Turkey Valley in Jackson Junction against New Hampton, Central Elkader, and South Winnesheek. Newman's opener is December 2nd at the Wapsie Valley Invitational. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, November 28th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and make it a great Tuesday.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction, and those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.